Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
And good morning. Good to be back in the big chair. Kristen, good to see you.
I missed that seat.
You sat in the big chair?
I sat in the big chair the entire time you were gone.
Did it feel any different?
I mean, there's one more monitor.
There is.
So there's a little bit more space to spread out all your the things that you want to reference and have more visuals. But besides that, I don't know if the lighting's better in that seat, but
it's fine. I don't like the lighting in the studio to begin with.
I don't think anyone likes the lighting.
It's the most unflattering lighting that we could have picked for this space. Because, I mean, you're a good-looking woman, if I can say that over
there. Thank you.
But even you,
even I look terrible.
Like, you have jaundice sometimes. Like, what's going on with her? She's sick. And you were sick last week, too.
And I still powered through. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. So far, it sounds like I didn't get anyone else sick in the studio for still coming into work sick. But when you weren't here, the show had to go on. So I was here, powered through. We made it through a very busy week. And live to tell about
it. I wish I could say that I was paying attention to what was going on, but I literally spent the weekend last weekend in LA in that area, and which was fantastic and great weather. Then I got on a nice boat and we kind of cruised in and out of Mexico and Sonora and some other places. Just fantastic.
I'm very happy for you. I'm very happy for you. Yeah.
So I didn't really think about the news, but obviously,
and then you came back to a unbelievably terrible 24 hours. I think 48 hours worth of news, unbelievable violence to the three main stories this morning.
Horrific stories.
And it's just, I read this morning, I think it was on Threads, that's the quote. The human nervous system wasn't built for this whiplash of parenting sweet, small children, punctuated by silently absorbing the horrors of a 24-hour global news cycle. And I thought about that. I thought about I spent all day Saturday and Sunday just hanging out with Frankie. And she's just at such a fun age right now, too, and just talking and curious and playing. You know, she's at the age now where I have my little Santas out, and she's using them as dolls. And it's like, all right, just be careful. But she hasn't broken any of them yet, but she just listening to her talk silently to herself as she's playing with these dolls, and then opening your phone and witnessing this. It's just
I guess my question
terrible.
For you as a young mom, and I probably should have asked my daughters this question already, because my oldest grandson, Max, is nearly 10, and obviously the rest of them are younger than that. How does a parent now approach this? I don't want to say every day, but such a common problem. We're talking about different countries, different cultures, but the same story: guns being used to kill people indiscriminately. In the case of the United States, Brown University, obviously a couple people killed there, others injured. In the case of Australia, their first celebration of Hanukkah on a beach, Bondi Beach to be specific, 16 people killed, confirmed, 42 to 43 people injured. How do you even approach that as a mom? I mean, Frankie's probably too young to dig deep on that stuff, but
yes.
I would imagine kids in grade school, elementary schools are they see this stuff.
Well, the kids in elementary school have to do active shooter drills.
Yeah.
They absolutely understand that. That was the thing that, it's not the first time that this has happened, but two of the students at Brown right now, this is their second mass shooting event, right? There was a young woman who survived Parkland only to go to Brown and be there for this, that was interviewed over the weekend. And so it's interesting. It's not interesting. That's not the right word. But as far as what happened in Australia being so shocking because they've had such strong gun laws. It's the last time there was anything like that. This had happened was 30 years ago. And that's what sparked the increase in a 650,000 mandatory gun buyback and all of the different rules that they actually changed. And so it's so much more unexpected to see something like that in Australia. And it's so sad to know that this is not unexpected here.
So the part that perplexes me, and these things are always horrific, and I've certainly spent a lot of my career on the radio talking about these various stories, and even before that as an elected official. Different cultures, different rules. You just talked about how strict the gun rules, yet we still see these things happening. These were licensed gun owners in Australia, which is sort of a hard process to go through. Father and a son, obviously intent on killing members of the Jewish community, because they went after an event that was sort of wrapped around the celebration of Hanukkah. There's no easy answers on this stuff. And I wonder, is this not a sort of an indication that, one, there's too many guns, one, there's too many bad people with guns, and frankly, the proliferation of firearms is obscene in this country. And I'm sorry if Second Amendment folks don't like it, but it is. But at the same time, when you have strict gun laws in California or other places or Australia, these things are still happening. Now, they happen less, but they're still happening. And maybe this points to the solution is sort of this anger out there. Don't know the mental state of these individuals who are involved in this, but, you know, we always talk about mental health. Maybe that has to be going after the anger, going after the any mental health concerns that play into these stories. And I don't want all the mental health experts to say it's not their fault, you know, whatever. I think we have to start looking at that piece of the story beyond just the guns, of which there are too many. I think that has to be some of the focus here, especially when you find places like Australia or other places that have strict gun laws, yet it still happens. It permeates our culture now, and it's obscene. And the reason I asked the question about young people and children is, if you witness trauma all the time and you hear about it, how does that not impact your mental health going forward from being a child to a young adult to an adult? How do you not have that built into your headset that that's one sort of the common way that people react to trauma now is to just reach, you know, to grab a gun.
Yeah.
Or in that case, just go after people. It's so obscene to me that as smart as this world can be with technology and science, and I realize I'm saying that at the same time as I say that we don't use some of those tools, that we can't at least find some way to slow this down. Nothing's perfect. I get that. It's just, as the texter says, my stomach is sick about this. It always is. Because you should not be killed in the act of going to a beach or going to a celebration of your faith or going to school. Yet we continue to just accept it. Like it's normal. It's not normal. That's what frustrates me. And I know there's no easy answers. 855-616-1620 is the Siding Unlimited WTMJ talk and text line. I don't expect you to have the answer either. But at some point, as a country and as a culture and as a global world, don't we have to figure something out? Or are we just going to say this is just the
this part? Is just the way that it is?
Yeah. I'm not happy with the that's the way it is.
No, I'm not happy with it either. It what complicates this, and I think is the back-to-back in very different cultures and very different rules. And what I don't know if we know anything that can connects it, but inevitably beyond just the proximity of the timing that it happened is potentially what connects it, especially because we don't know, you know, one of the one shooter is dead in Australia. Mm-hmm. One is in a coma.
Right.
We have no idea who the Brown University shooter
still
is
large,
because
yeah.
It's still at large. They are still at large. And so as far as motivation or anything like that, we don't know. I mean, clearly it seems like the Australia shooting has anti-Semitic undertones to it that are feel like they're obvious to come to that conclusion. But as far as just the anger that simmers inside of people that they feel like the only answer is to kill strangers, that is something I don't know beyond mental health experts. How do we even tackle that as a society?
She is Kristen. I am Steve. It's good to be back on Point Taken. Thanks for taking the time to find us. We'll continue the conversation with you after this on 620 WTMJ. Kristen and Steve on this Monday edition. These stories are never easy to talk about. And, you know, layered into the attack on Bondi Beach in Australia where 16 people were killed. And Brown University where two more people were killed and others injured. And that shooter or shooters are still at large. Then you weave in the Rob Reiner story, which is not a gun death, apparently, because it was Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle, where they were apparently attacked. His son, Nick, has now been arrested, who has had years of issues with addiction and apparently some mental health issues as well.
And he's been in and out of homelessness.
Which is a common problem. One of the things I remember from my days as an elected official is parents would reach out to me and go, we're at our wit's end. We have a child who he won't listen. He's half time homeless, half the time threatening us. What do we do? And there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
And you know, the decision to remove that person from your household or in the case of the Reiners, to sort of do everything they could. I just saw an interview with Rob Reiner filmed a while ago talking about his son.
Well, they did a movie together. They did a documentary together called Being Charlie, as far as documenting his struggles. And I saw an interview where he was saying, he's like, doing this together, I learned so much more about addiction. I learned so much more about him. And so it wasn't like we've cut you off. I mean, I have no idea, right? But as far as the attempts, it seems like throughout his life to help, as a parent does when they have a child who struggles with those kinds of things. I mean, that was just talk about a way to end the night. Literally laying in bed last night, Mike sent me like a feel good video, and I was like, this is how I was going to end. And then he said that headline of what found dead in their house. And I was like, so of course then I went down the rabbit hole of that. And just like I said, it was just the violence of the headlines this morning of these three stories is just, especially this close to Christmas. And I mean, I know that doesn't, but it reminds me last year, we were this close to Christmas. I mean, did we just have the Abundant Christian Life?
Yes.
Anniversary, yeah, right? And yeah. I remember how shocking that was for me to have to go on air and talk about a school in my hometown this close to Christmas. And I know it always matters no matter what time of year it is, but there is something about this time of year that just feels extra heavy when this kind of horrible violence happens.
I asked you this before, and I want to sort of revisit this. So as a parent of a young child, when you react to stories like this and you sort of think about where we go next, obviously there's always this, you know, these weird patterns where we grieve, and then we sort of have the vigil, and then we say, what can we do? And then sort of fades to the next one, right? As a parent of a younger child or children, are you confident that as a country, United States, I'm talking about, even though one of these is in Australia, that we have the willingness to?
No.
No?
Absolutely not.
So have you said, because this is the give up question, because I get asked this question a lot.
I think those are two different things.
Okay, tell me why.
The give up question is, I mean, you never give up, right? Like that is the whatever political activism, awareness, involvement that you have as a person who cares about making your community, your city, your state, your country better. Like to give up is, and just to be a recluse and just focus on yourself. Like, I mean, at least for me, I'm not wired like that, right? Like I couldn't just turn it off, because this is my job. But if I wanted to quit this job, just focus on my family, my friends, not pay attention to the news. Like I'm not built that way. So as far as continuing to talk about it, continuing to vote for politicians who say they want to work on this, like that is a different question as far as giving up. My thought that within Frankie's childhood into adulthood that we will have meaningful change, I don't have a lot of optimism for that.
So I will always blame the weapon of choice. In the case of Rob Reiner, it's apparently a knife. In the case of these other shootings, they're, you know, serious firepower, serious guns. That is the instrument of death. But I've talked about this issue so much. To me, I do point fingers at the world of social media. I do point fingers at our culture that sort of celebrates in some weird way anger, the trolling that goes on, the anonymous people who post. Now we find out that most of the stuff is just in these labs, apparently, where they just constantly churn out things to sort of contaminate our culture, sometimes by other countries, sometimes just by evildoers or people who are not looking out for the best interests of the United States or whatever country they're trying to attack. So I do think that all of these things are sort of contributing to this, my word, escalation. One of the things that so much frustrates me is that I know that we're going to talk about this because we know that this is an important topic to cover. As someone, both of us, who talk about these things for a living, this is something I would never like push it aside. Oh, let's talk about Wisconsin politics. No, this is something that is fundamental to our health, our safety, our mental health, our culture, even our forms of government. And if we can't wrap our heads around this or figure something out, I feel like we are just playing the game and not trying to fix the game, not trying to fix what ails us. And I am extremely frustrated on this occasion and any occasion where we talk about these subjects with the unwillingness of some of us to engage on this. There are radio stations in this country today will ignore all these stories, and they'll talk about politics du jour, whatever that is today. And we'll certainly get to some of that. But that's my frustration. If you are a provider of news or news talk or just content in the sphere of radio beyond what it is, what it used to be and what it is now, you have to be involved in this conversation. And I do blame people who churn out anger every day and discontents and label people. I think it's dangerous. And I think that's a big part of this problem. So I will not be party to that. And I will call out those people who I think are just not serving the public interest. We sort of abandon that public interest for self-interest in a lot of cases. I don't think you're that person, and I hope that I'm not that person. But there are a lot of people who I think that's their main focus in life. Quick break. We can't go to news without talking about this. An incredible, heroic...
Unbelievable. Yeah. So I'm sure if you follow the story of the Bondi Beach shooting in Australia, you've probably also seen the video of Ahmed Al-Ahmed, a 43-year-old father of two, who ran toward one of the shooters from behind, tackled him, and was able to wrestle the gun away from him. And it is truly, I mean, I know there's been stories of like this sometimes, I think, in America, as far as the bravery of people who run toward a shooter in the attempt to save more people. And he was shot twice. I think he's in stable condition, the last I heard. But to witness that on camera, as far as to give hope, as far as people being motivated to do heroic things in such a scary position. And then there has been other moments I've seen. This is like the good side of social media, right? I saw an exchange. Oh, we have to go. But
we'll
pick it up after this. Yeah.
She's Chris and I'm Steve. Lots more of the show to come. We're going to talk about a lot of things on the show today as I'm back. Always appreciate each and every one of you finding us on the live program. And you can, of course, you can watch us on YouTube. You can watch us on our live stream at WTMJ.com, which is always a great option. And of course, traditional radio, if you got the old little transistor radio. God bless you. There's not many folks. I still have one of those, by the way.
Transistor radio?
Yeah, batteries, little antenna.
How often do you use it?
Once in a while in the summer when I'm outside and I'm kind of tooling around and I have my phone with me.
Right.
I'll pop that sucker on. You got to change batteries a lot, but it's the way people consume radio for a long time, the little transistors. And mine was given to me by a relative, so I appreciated that. You want to make some final thoughts about the story?
So as far as acknowledging the man who was able to disarm the shooter in Bondi Beach. But then I also saw a really sweet exchange between a rabbi. This was at Atlanta. Is a rabbi who was, I think, tabling and had his yarmulke on. Obviously, it's the beginning of Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah to everyone who celebrates. And a man came up and just, it was all caught on video. And he said, you know, I'm so sorry for what happened. And it turned out that man was Muslim. And they just had a really beautiful exchange as far as these two cultures that we know on the global scale is at war. But to understand the individual humanity, especially for two religions that do, when you actually read the text, including Christianity, right? These are three texts that overlap and have so many similarities as far as being kind to one another, protecting one another. And when you actually practice that, we could actually try to get along and celebrate the dignity and sanctity of human life versus what divides us and what we create as the separation between religions.
So in the course of my travel, especially in the LA area, I took a lot of Ubers around town. And I,
you took any Waymos?
No.
The driverless ones?
No, I didn't do that.
You didn't test it? Okay.
I'm not opposed to it. I'd really like to see what it's about. But first of all, Uber drivers, you're amazing. And they got us where we needed to go in brilliant fashion. Had great recommendations for restaurants, all that stuff. Nothing to do with what I'm talking about. But the drivers, I had a Sikh American driver, Sikh community. I had a Muslim driver. I had a Native American driver. And because I'm me, I'm always trying to, I'm probing, and Kathy sometimes gets irritated, but I can't sit there for like, you know, 45 minutes and not have a conversation. Like, we're existing in the same space. Let's talk. Mm-hmm. And we did it civilly, and they were amazing. Now, there were some Trump supporters in that group. I'm not going to, you know, point the direction at which one was which, but there were folks who don't like Trump. But amazingly, one of the shared sort of concepts of these sometimes long-winded conversations, hopefully not just me talking, was that they love the country that they're working in. And in this case, they love Southern California.
Were they all, obviously not the Native American, but were they people who were not born, like predominantly born
two
here?
Two were born here, one wasn't. Three major ones that I talked to. But they love the country they're from, but they have vastly different ideas on the performance of the president. There was a Trump supporter that kind of surprised me because she, and her name was Tanya, said to me, every time she said something that defended the president, she goes, I hope I'm not going to get struck down by God. Because she was saying some things that, you know, supported the president on his border policy. Hmm. And I go, here's the thing. Those things are nuanced. You can support, because as someone who doesn't live in L.A., I'm not going to pretend to tell you what you should feel about the way that some of the systems of the protection system, support systems, have been just brutalized by an onslaught of people who come into this country and don't participate in the right way. And I just was so fascinated to hear these people describe, and all their different backgrounds, sort of the same thing we talk about, the struggle to figure these things out and to understand politics at this moment is not a pacifier. It's a disruptor, and it's not just the elected officials, not just the organizations, the parties. It's the people who support them, including all of us, who sometimes like to play that game, you know, like to push the button, like to, you know, poke the bear. And I think that understanding, I was informed by those conversations, and I celebrate that because even with the difference among us, different backgrounds, different thoughts about this president and the administration and the country in general, we could have a civil conversation in the back of a, what do we drive in? We were in a Tesla one time and a something else the other time. We could have those conversations and try to sort things out in our own unique ways. And that's, to me, how this stuff gets sorted out. But here's where the rubber meets the road. That's the first part of the story. The second part of the story, and even beyond that, is taking those thoughts and using them constructively, not agitating, but actually constructing a society where you can have that blend, which I just talked about, mm-hmm. and a diversity of opinions, but not hate each other because we're different. Diversity is a celebration of life, not a hindrance.
It's a strength.
It's a strength. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see these attacks that come out every day and, you know, people are just pushing the buttons on people to try to get them to blow up, I guess. And I always say to people when they come at me, what's your motivation here? Like,
have you ever gotten a good answer to that question?
No.
As far as what they're trying to get
they
out of it
shut
by
down
poking?
Or go away. And I'll be honest, I don't attack them back. I just say, what's your motivation here?
That's usually my go-to. If I choose to respond to a DM or something like that, it's like, what is your goal out of this exchange? So I know how to best respond to your critique or attack of me at this moment.
You know, to just willy-nilly just want to throw negativity around like it doesn't have consequences, it does. We all want to raise our families and have a good quality of life, celebrate all the fun things. This is an amazing country, and next year we'll celebrate 250 years of this country being an independent country of amazing diversity. I think people forget that story. Well, I know they forget that story because it's not a group of white people who figured it all out. The story of the success of the United States is all the people that went into that. Because as an Italian-American, we were considered the others at some point. Mm-hmm. I had relatives who were beaten to an inch of their life in New Orleans and in Chicago and even in Cudahy, Wisconsin, because of who they were.
It was very recent that Italian-Americans were considered white.
Yeah, very recently. Because they weren't. And think about all those others out there who just want to do the right thing. It shouldn't be that complicated. So if you're one of those people that demonizes people for being different, I'm sorry, but you're part of the problem. You have to celebrate it. I'm not saying you have to adopt everything they want to do. You're not going to eat the food they want, they make. That's not what we're asking.
Although you may be missing out.
You may be missing out. I had some great food on my trip, trust me. And it wasn't food that we created, us white people. Did I go off topic?
A little bit, but that's okay. You were passionate.
All right. You want to talk about the governor's race?
No, when we come back, we're going to check in with Neil Doyle, who's location for
Even
the
better.
Hannah Dugan trial, because today is the first day. So we will check in with Neil to get a little bit of a taste of what it's like over at the courthouse. So stay with us. It's Point Taken.
It is Monday, not Victory Monday. We'll get to that later in the second hour. Alex Strofe will join us. Was it last week he joined us or the week? No, 2 weeks ago because I was gone last week. To sort of pick up the pieces, the post-mortem of the Packers.
And did you cry a little bit?
No, but I wasn't happy about it. But I sort of, as my wife always does, she goes, it's not the end of the world. I mean, they have 3 games left to play or whatever it is. You know, here's what I said. I don't want to get too far off because let's just go to Neil.
Yeah, we got plenty of time left on the show. We'll talk about it later. All right, let's go to WTMJ's newsrooms. Neil Doyle, who is at the courthouse right now for the beginning of the Hannah Dugan trial. How is it over there, Neil?
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
They're underway. Opening statements got underway just after 9 o'clock or so. A pretty crowded courtroom for the opening statements from both the prosecution and defense. Those wrapped up just shortly ago, probably about 15 minutes or so. And then there was about a 10-minute break, and the first witnesses are now being called by the prosecution. So things are certainly underway here in this trial.
From the journalist's perspective, how would you characterize the opening statements?
I think it's kind of what we expected from the prosecution.
Neil, let's call you back really quickly because your connection on the Comrex seems to be roboty.
We'll stick with it, but let's let Neil connect by phone. I hope he knows the hotline to the studio. I'm sure he does. Because I want to hear what he has to say because I'm curious how this case opened.
I'm curious because I said this last week as we talked about it with, as you missed, we had a new guest fill in for Bill McCashin on Friday, Hilario De Leon, who is the chairman of the Milwaukee County Republicans. And he was here and Zubecki was here. And obviously the case matters. It is due process as far as her getting her day in court to be able to, have a jury of her peers to say, okay, let's get Neil back on the phone.
All right, Neil, I asked you the question. I don't know if you heard it or not. Characterize the opening statements.
Yeah, the prosecution went about 45 minutes, I would say, right around there with their opening statements and kind of hit on some of the key pieces of evidence that are going to be presented throughout the trial to this jury. Now, there's some audio they're going to be using from inside of Judge Dugan's courtroom on the day that all of this went down, according to the prosecution, back in April 18th when Judge Dugan is accused of helping an undocumented immigrant evade the federal agents who were at the courthouse to take him into custody. So they say they've got some different pieces of evidence, audio from the courtroom. There's, of course, video that has been out there already from some of the exchanges that happened in the public hallway outside the courtroom, but there is no audio from that. So it's kind of interesting, which audio and video aspect the prosecution says they're going to use. And part of their case really kind of hinges on the steps of a court proceeding in which they're claiming Judge Dugan obstructed, and that's why she's facing charge for obstruction and concealment. So that's kind of some of what they hit on. And the defense kind of coming back, and it was kind of interesting that one of the first lines Judge Dugan's attorneys threw out is, you know, this is probably the most important week of her professional life. Yeah, this is getting obviously a lot of national attention, this case. Because it has to do with the federal government, you know, prosecuting a judge, something that we've not really seen done before. So, you know, the defense, you know, is laying out that she acted within her judicial powers. And, you know, she has claimed that she is innocent and is, you know, going, they say that they are going to claim and show that she is innocent and acted within what she was supposed to do. So the defense didn't take quite as long with their opening statement. I would say 30-35 minutes. They did take a quick break, but now the first witness is getting called here on day one.
Neil, as you said, there's been national coverage. What's the media like there? Like, can you kind of set the scene as far as who's all there, what outlets you're seeing?
Yeah, I got here at about 7:30 this morning. The courthouse opened at about 8, and then, of course, the trial started at 9. As I got here at 7:30, there were a number of, you know, some of our local TV stations, but some other national TV stations. I believe I saw Reuters, actually CNN. I believe CBS had a camera nationally outside the courthouse as well. And it's pretty crowded, I would say, media-wise. They've got a media workroom that people are stationed in. There's actually a broadcast room where I'm down now on the first floor. And there are some media within the courtroom itself as well. So certainly a lot of people, you know, keeping their eyes on this trial as it's going to unfold here the next couple of days.
Any ideas on the length of this trial, estimated length of this case?
Yeah, from what we've heard, you know, the prosecution is planning to probably call around 24, if not more, witnesses. And that means this will probably go through at least Thursday. Judge Adelman, Lynn Adelman, who is presiding over this case, has told the jury and has told, you know, told us as well that this will be at least 4 to 5 days. So we could, you know, see a possible verdict come down Thursday or Friday. But if things go longer, they've said they will certainly go into early next week if they need to.
Neil Doyle joining us from the courthouse. Thanks for the updates. I'm sure you'll be on that story all this week, as we all will be on 620 WTMJ, the Judge Hannah Dugan case. Thanks, Neil.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right, I'll take a quick break. Wrap the 10 o'clock hour right here on Point Taken on 620 WTMJ.
Just quickly, we had a texter text in asking how to watch the Hannah Dugan trial, and you cannot watch the Hannah Dugan trial because there is no recording, filming, photography allowed inside the federal courthouse. So obviously there is going to be lots of news coverage of local outlets that are there. I know the Journal Sentinel and other news organizations have hired a courtroom sketch artist to provide illustrations from inside the courtroom. But there is, and then Reuters has a live video feed outside the courthouse, but there will not be anything inside to watch the actual testimony or opening statements or anything like that.
Real quick, somebody asked us to comment on the sick post that Donald Trump put out on his Truth Social account. I'm not going to read it because it's just weird. And it's something so unpresidential, it should have never been put out. And he's trying to make a case that Rob Reiner, who is now deceased, and his wife Michelle are somehow, you know, they're dead because of the Trump derangement syndrome, which, I mean, who does?
I don't know.
Is there no governor on this president? No one that says to him, don't put that out.
I don't know.
It's sickening and disgusting.
My final thoughts before we go to break on that is I do wonder, coming back to the beginning of the conversation as far as how angry everyone is and the temperature. And this is, we do have a president who just refuses to ever say the thing that lowers the temperature. And I do wonder, once he's not in office, if some of this will go away. And I don't know. I do not have a crystal ball, but as far as our leader in chief being someone who constantly just has to have a dig when he's bleeding on Truth Social or wherever, if that's a main cause of how angry so many people are, either in reaction to him or in support of the things that he's saying.
It's crazy. It's the words of a lunatic, and I don't know how anyone could defend it. And I know our friend Bill McCutcheon said this is absolutely inexcusable as well. So those aren't his words, my words, but that's basically what he said. Should not have happened, but yet the words are out there. We'll take a break for the news, which is next on 620 WTMJ.
The work week is here. Let's begin with your Monday market preview with Annex Wealth Management Chief Economic Strategist, Dr. Brian Jacobson on Point Taken.
Indeed, indeed. A little change up today on our market talk with Dr. Brian Jacobson. How are you doing this morning?
Fantastic. We have a warm-up going on, so that's fantastic.
Oh, my gosh, right? This weekend was just... Did you get any of the cold, Steve?
I wasn't here.
I know. Were you back? You were back yesterday, so you got a little bit of it.
Well, I told the story, not to derail our conversation, but I got back. I had to snowplow my driveway. I was in 80s. And it was like 5 degrees.
You're like, welcome back, Biddy.
Welcome back to Wisconsin,
welcome
Steve.
Welcome back.
Car in your driveway.
So, we did get a cut last week, which is exciting, right? Good news, would you say?
I thought that was good news.
Okay.
You know, and the messaging around it, I think, is what was most important. The fact that they cut rates and Chair Powell didn't try to play the Grinch and try to downplay it and saying that, you know, this is the last one that we're going to do for a while. He did basically say that the labor market has been softening. They've been taking notice of that. They had a robust discussion. Yes, there are still fears about inflation. It's not back at their target, but that the balance of risks, when you look at the labor market, inflation, they're a little bit more concerned about the labor market. So they figured it was prudent to take some action. So I thought that the messaging around it is what the market reacted most positively to.
Got it.
Brian, the president has floated the idea that he should, in the office of president, should have an active role in setting the rates. Good idea, bad idea? What do you think?
Well, you know, we do have a lot of academic evidence on the importance of the independence of a central bank to be freed of some of that political influence. Now, there's a difference between consulting with the president, and then the president controlling what happens. So if President Trump wants to have like a meeting with the chair beforehand just to discuss what's going on and his perspective, you know, that has happened before. But the question is whether or not that would actually lead to the president dictating policy. And the way that I oftentimes think about these things is that, you know, no matter what team you're on, right, somebody from the other team is going to be in that office at some point. And would you want that person having that same type of power and influence? And just generally speaking, there are some bad examples, especially from, like, let's say, Richard Nixon and also from Lyndon Baines Johnson, about the influence they had over the Fed and the bad economic outcomes that resulted from it.
They have until January to decide, right? Because that's when that next meeting is after the holidays. Do you think we'll see a... Is it would be the fourth rate cut?
Fourth, yeah.
Yeah, that would be the fourth one this year. I don't think we're going to get four in January there. So I'm thinking maybe let's wait until June, mostly because the messaging was we need to wait for a little bit more data. They've actually come a long ways in terms of adjusting rates. So 0.75% last year, 0.75% this year. And they feel as though they are pretty close to what they think is what's called neutral. So this neutral interest rate, it's rather vague. And basically, it just means what's that level for that federal funds rate, that short-term borrowing rate between banks that was neither really pushing on the accelerator or pushing on the brake. And they think that's pretty close to about 3%. I don't think that's really misguided or anything. And if they want to get to neutral, they're within spitting distance of it. And so they feel as though let's at least maybe take January off, and then they can have March as an option. And I think that's a pretty reasonable expectation.
Got it. All right. So we are getting the delayed government data that was we did not receive because of the government shutdown. And so this is going to be November jobs reports, U.S. retail sales, CPI. What do you think we should expect? Is there any other tangential data that did come out? We talk about ADP data and stuff like that, that indicates what we can expect from this delayed report, these delayed reports.
Sure. And it's almost like an early Christmas gift, you know, to get these released. I can unwrap them tomorrow. So tomorrow we'll be getting that labor market report that is for October and November. Okay. So it's not the most up to date. It's, you know, kind of clearing the backlog here. The retail sales numbers, those are for the month of October. So again, a little bit dated. And then on Thursday, we're going to be getting the inflation numbers for the month of November. So these are very backward looking. Most of the time, the data we get from the government is backward looking. This is just backward looking on steroids. I think that really what it will show is that some of this higher frequency, more timely data that we have gotten from like ADP, that it is likely showing that October and November, there was still job destruction on net. So when we look across firms in terms of size, industry and that, so probably a decline. But there was that glimmer of hope with the most recent numbers that came out from ADP, suggesting that towards the end of November, that actually began to get a little bit more positive. So the key question is this more of that turning point? So was this a rough patch for the labor market? And now we can get a little bit more traction going into the new year and through the new year. That's where some of the other data, ADP, but then also there's like purchasing manager indices. Those are pointing towards, I think, reason for some optimism going into the holidays as opposed to more pessimism.
All right.
He is Dr. Brian Jacobson, Chief Economic Strategist for Annex Wealth Management. I was lucky enough to be at two huge shipping ports, Long Beach, California, Ensenada, Mexico. And I'm interested in sort of the role of transportation, moving of goods. We're going to ask Brian questions about that after this on 620 WTMJ.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. He is Steve Scafidi, and we are on the line. You can actually see him. He's not just on the phone. He is
looking
on
good.
The YouTube. If you text watch to 855-616-1620. We are talking to Annex Wealth Management Chief Economic Strategist, Dr. Brian Jacobson. All right. I'm interested in this because when the numbers first came out post Black Friday, Cyber Monday, we saw a spike. But the question was the devil in the details of that information as far as how much was on credit cards or pay later, how much was just because the price of things is more expensive versus the number of things that were actually bought. So as far as looking at what we saw with Black Friday and Cyber Monday and going into the holidays, what do you think is going to happen with holiday markets, holiday spending?
Yeah, that is some great nuance, the way that you're looking at that data, mostly because we get the nominal number. So that's volume and price. And then it's also about, you know, is this on credit card? Are people overspending? Are they using credit cards because they don't have the cash to do it? Are they using this new technology, the buy now, pay later, which is actually just kind of a throwback to the old days of layaway that used to be a thing as well. And when we kind of break it down, so American Express, they announced that basically the Black Friday sales were up 9%. Mm-hmm. They tend to cater towards higher income individuals. And then when we looked at the MasterCard spending pulse data, that's much more broad based, but it is a little bit more kind of, you know, your middle class and then also, going down the income spectrum a little bit. That was up 4%. So I think it does show that divide between the spending that was being done by higher income consumers. And with American Express, a lot of that has paid off right away, right? Use it for the points. And so I think that it was showing that people are feeling the strain, but they're not breaking necessarily. So there was that increase in the credit card spending. Not necessarily a great thing. You don't want people paying the 22% interest rate on that. But the level of the dollar amount that's being rolled over, so not being paid off right away, is in line with historical norms. So I think the consumer is, despite all the pessimism that's out there and the broad narrative, they're still doing what they do best, which is consume.
Yeah.
Brian, before the break, I mentioned I was at two major ports, Long Beach, California, which is one of the significant West Coast ports, mm-hmm. and then Ensenada, Mexico. Busy, like beehive busy. And I noticed as I was doing some research for your appearance that transportation stocks often sort of signal where the economy is going. Is that indication of busy ports, products moving around, does that suggest a strong rally for investors that we might have some good news coming as far as goods moving around?
It is one of those really tried and true data points that we'd like to follow is how are transportation stocks doing? And with transportation, it's the shipping, it's the railroads, it's the delivery vehicles and that. And that's part of what's called Dow theory, where it looks at, okay, transportation stocks leading the broader market, so industrials. And then you also have utility stocks as far as kind of confirming that type of signal. And I do think that there is that reason for optimism. Keep in mind, there have been a ton of distortions over the last year in terms of with just the shifting of trade lines and the such. So when I'm looking at the high frequency data, as far as not just the volume of the shipping coming to the United States, but then also the cost of shipping, it does look like it's basically this diversion from trade with China to trade with other countries. Mm. But because of a little bit of the calming of the tension between the U.S. and China, that has restarted. So I think that's maybe what you were seeing there, because you could actually see probably the shipping containers, some of the, you know, where is this coming from? There has been an unseasonable increase in the shipping from China, mostly, I think, because it was like really put on stop for a while, and now they're trying to play a little game of catch up.
That's the detail you get with a chief economic strategist, Dr. Brian Jacobson. All right, are we going to see, this is the sort of our wrap up question, a Santa rally as the market, what is that, 48 something? Will we see a Santa rally?
Well, I expect so, and the reason is, using data going back to about 1929, it has happened 79% of the time. So, I mean, the odds are in favor. Now, there's a number of factors at work there, one of which is taxes, right? Do you want to sell a stock in this calendar year, or do you want to wait one, you know, a few days to sell it in 2026? Because that would affect whether or not you owe taxes on that in April of next year, so 2026 or 2027. So it's like people are hesitant to sell. And if they have a little bit of spending money, that's when, you know, they got some gifts, maybe that's when they buy. So it's the last five trading days and the first two of the next year. That's the Santa Claus rally. Mm. And happens 79% of the time. But it's not something I would trade. It is something that I am expecting that we'd probably see, though.
Does that mean then in January we see a lot of sales typically?
Well, sometimes you do get a little selling pressure after that, but there's something called the January effect where you actually see small cap stocks typically outperform large cap ones.
Oh, Good to know.
All right. As somebody who does what you do for a living, chief economic strategist at Annex Wealth Management, annexwealth.com is where you can find all their great links and information and kind of restart your financial future. What would your Christmas wish for the economy be, Dr. Brian Jacobson?
Well, you know, peace on earth, goodwill to men, of course.
Those are the easy ones.
But I think moderating inflation and that turning point, that improvement in the labor market, that would be the sweet spot, I think, set us up for a very good 2026.
All right. Here's hoping.
Love it. Dr. Brian Jacobson, always appreciate your visits. Dave or Brian will join us next week.
If we don't see you, happy holidays.
You too. Thank you so much. Merry Christmas.
And as I always say, annexwealth.com. Click the now famous Get Started button. We'll wrap the first half hour of our second hour. Kristen and Steve, good to be back in the big chair as I sort of wind myself back into the work mode.
Getting used to it?
Yeah, I'm still working. It's a working
project. Getting some cobwebs off?
Huh?
Getting some cobwebs off?
Dusting the cobwebs off? We got something chasing you? She's Kristen. I'm Steve. Point taken.
All right. Well, while you were gone, Steve, we have yet another candidate.
Another candidate for governor. Who is it this time?
It's Joel Brennan.
Joel Brennan.
Which I think even before you went on vacation, there was, I think, an assumption that he was going to join.
I talked to Joel outside the studio before I left.
Oh, did he tell you?
No.
Oh, okay. But yeah, we had him on Friday. It was shorter than I would have liked, but that was okay. But he joined us, and I think we now have a final count of how many
people. What is the final number now for Democrats?
I think it's eight.
Eight.
Including Brett Halsey, who I'm not sure people are necessarily taking seriously.
Not a serious
but
candidate.
Seven serious candidates. So let's do it. Joey actually did it. Zepecki did it in alphabetical order. I'm not sure I can do that.
Wow.
But Mandela Barnes, Sarah Rodriguez, Kelda Royce, Missy Hughes, Joel Brennan, Francesca Hong, and
Crowley.
David Crowley.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Who's going to be on the show
Wednesday?
Wednesday.
He'll be here Wednesday morning. But more to talk about. County executive business,
yes,
rather than the campaign,
which is something
that I'm sure we'll ask about the campaign.
We do that a lot. We get a year-end review of what that work.
I'm trying
is like.
To think. That's actually an interesting thing to think about as far as the jobs that everyone has right now, while also campaigning. Because Missy stepped down from her job at the WDDC. Joel stepped down from his job at the GMC. Francesca Hong, Kelda Royce will both be basically out of session by March, April. Versus, depending on how you approach the job, how busy Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez will be. I feel like Crowley probably has the most demanding job to handle while also trying to campaign.
Not Mandela Barnes?
No. I'm going to say no.
Yeah, I think that's a safe
But answer. As far as, the job that you actually have to do, which I would say county executive, especially of the most populous county in the state, there's a lot that falls on you. While also trying to manage a campaign for governor.
I'm a big fan of County Executive Crowley. I've known him for a long time. He's on top of the stuff that he has to deal with on a daily basis. So I'm interested in hearing what he has to say on Wednesday. I don't really have a horse in this race, but I think it's a nice mix of candidates. I know you wrote a piece in the Journal Sentinel about sort of the entry of Mandela Barnes into this and what it means and certainly what these people stand for.
I think
it's probably more important.
A lot of people are eager for that. I had a lot of feedback online from that article. So my bigger point with that was, just by default, it feels like Mandela Barnes enters the race. And because of name recognition, because he's run a very high profile campaign not that long ago, he's the immediate front runner. And I think that's even the argument of why his name in the Badger poll earlier this year, before he had even announced or even was considering announcing, was showed him in a lead. But it's, it's name recognition versus my push in the article was, what are these people actually made of? What is their policy? What is their governing style? And actually getting deeper into who they are versus just defaulting because you recognize someone's name. But in that, in the attempt to make that argument, I also said, as of right now, it feels like a lot of these campaigns kind of sound the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hong Hive, which is, I think Zepecki maybe came up with that, but the Hong Hive online was very quick to remind me that she is running a very different campaign, which I would agree with. And so maybe it was a little lazy on my part not putting a caveat for her campaign versus the other six.
Does the fact that there is seven, would you say seven or eight serious candidates? Seven?
Seven.
And that one of them is Mandela Barnes. Doesn't that make it easier for Mandela Barnes to sort of automatically get the nomination just because he's more better known than all of them?
Oh, I don't think so.
No, you don't think so?
It may be easier for him to raise more money just because he already has, he's done this before. Again, online is not real life. How does that translate? We'll see. But I have not seen a lot of people coming to Mandela's defense.
Interesting. Hey, you think you got the smarts? Well, join. This is really relevant because he's in the studio. Alex Strofe from our partners at ESPN 94.5 and from our fantastic Packers coverage. But now he's doing a little trivia thing. We call it WTMJ Trivia Showdown Wednesday nights. December 7th. Is that this Wednesday?
That's this Wednesday.
I think you're all screwed up. 7 p.m. The Hot House Tavern. Never been in Menominee Falls. Presented by Quizmaster Trivia. Benefiting, of course, Capco's Kids. The Kids Toy Drive. Bring an unused toy. Text TOY to 855-616-1620. Donates early and often. Yes.
How'd you get looped into this? How did we swoop you from ESPN to be like, hey, you're going to do a trivia night? Did you just get told or did you offer?
No, I offered. So a little fun fact about Alex Strofe that maybe you don't know. So while I was in college, I ran I was the station manager for several years at my college radio station, Stevens Point, 90 FM. And 90 FM hosts the world's largest trivia contest.
I didn't know this.
So I love trivia. Okay. I went last week down in your neck of the woods in Oak Creek, mm-hmm. when Vinny, Sandy Max,
anybody
Eric,
ask
Pinky.
About me? Or, nobody?
Everyone. No,
the only people that asked
First
me
Steve,
about you
said,
how do you work with this guy every Sunday?
Yeah, it's,
and I said,
common,
you should ask Kristen that question.
Common
she
question.
Probably has a better answer.
Yeah,
so,
we got that.
Yeah. But anyway, that's how I got roped in. I love trivia. I'm looking forward to being up in Menominee Falls this Wednesday. Hope you can join us beginning at 7 o'clock.
All right, so in our show description, Alex Strofe, I said this is sort of, and I did it on purpose because I want to get your reaction, the postmortem on yesterday, and hopefully not the postmortem on the season because there's a lot of football to be played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your thoughts about what happened or what unfolded yesterday in Denver?
It sucked.
Thanks, everybody.
How eloquently can I put that?
Yeah,
it sucked. Look, at the end of the day, I'm a fan. I'm a Packers fan. I grew up in Green Bay. I cheer for the team. I am by no means a journalist, so I'm going to give you the fan perspective. It sucked. When you lose a guy like Micah Parsons, who has come in this season and just changed everything about that defense, about the team, about the expectations, and you lose him to what is feared to be an ACL, and I'm no doctor, but that certainly looked like an ACL tear.
It looked.
Yeah, it was nasty.
Just the recoil of that reaction and how he landed and buckled. It was like, oh!
None of us doctors, but I think we all knew what that was.
It looked nasty.
So, yeah, it changes. I don't want to call it postmortem because I still think this is a team that can win the NFC North. I still think this is a team that can go to Chicago in 5 days on Saturday and win. But I think your Super Bowl chances have certainly dwindled with now losing both Micah Parsons and Tucker Kraft to torn ACLs.
That's sort of an amazing thing. Now, you brought with you the bearer of some good news, and that is about Christian Watson, star receiver of the Packers.
Yeah, so that looked nasty. I initially thought there was probably a collarbone or
That's
a separated shoulder or something bad. So when they initially ruled him out, they ruled it a chest injury, which kind of threw me off. Because typically, I know the collarbone technically connects to the chest, but that's typically designated as a shoulder injury. Then he went to the hospital, so that perked my ears up. Turned out they were looking if he had damaged his lung. Ultimately, he did, and he flew back
collapsed
with the team.
Collapsed lung is what they're looking at, right?
Yeah. And ultimately it sounds like he kind of got out without anything terrible. I mean, obviously his shoulder's going to be hurt a little bit, maybe a bruise or something, but
potentially could play next week, could play on Saturday.
Yeah. That's the initial ruling.
So obviously we had the game in Green Bay. How many days ago? 9 days, whatever the heck it was. I don't even know. Mm-hmm. How many days ago was it?
It was 8 days ago.
Eight days.
Yeah, you were in L.A. or Mexico at that point.
I was still in L.A.
This is the second time, Kristen, he's mentioned this segment that, I was on vacation while you guys were freezing. How many times has he done that today?
A lot. I think every segment.
Yeah. Well,
humble brag.
It's my reality. So should I talk about things I know? Good writers write about things they've
experienced. Pina coladas in Mexico. Really good. That's what I know.
We didn't discuss what his drink of choice was on this vacation.
Maybe at the end of the segment. Anyway, so that was a great outcome for the Packers. They beat the Bears by 7 points. It was closer than a lot of us thought it would be, at least me. But now we go to Chicago this Saturday night, primetime game. And I asked you this question during the break before you came on. If Matt LaFleur thinks he's a great coach, and this is a team that maybe doesn't have Super Bowl aspirations anymore, given the things you just talked about, shouldn't this still be a game, especially if you have Christian Watson, that they can still win in Chicago?
My answer is yes, but I would come back on you and say, I think you're more critical of Matt LaFleur than the average bird.
I don't know why that is.
I don't either. I've caught on to it.
Wait, you don't know why you're more critical, or you don't know why other people aren't more critical?
Yeah, the second, the latter. I'm critical of Matt LaFleur because he has been handed an outstanding, one of the best ever, Aaron Rodgers quarterback, and some pretty good teams. Mm-hmm. You can argue about the defenses with those Aaron Rodgers-led teams. He's been in critical situations in the playoffs where he has not taken them to the next step. He's had one playoff win in his tenure since then, right?
Yeah, the Dallas game,
which was incredible. I would give it to more Jordan Love, but you know, he can take some credit. But I need him to show me something that at this point in his tenure, which is 7 years in a contract year, right?
Technically, yeah. The new not owner, but CEO and president, Ed Policy, said he doesn't want lame duck years. He has 2 years counting this year left in his contract. So next year would technically be a contract year, but he doesn't want lame duck. So either at the end of this year, they're going to make some sort of decision on the floor.
So given the challenges that you've been handed to, lost one of your best offensive weapons, now your best defensive star.
I hear you on all this. I agree with you because at the end of the day, you do have a quarterback who's playing really good football. And obviously the air kind of came out of the balloon yesterday with all those injuries and you know, they wound up in turmoil, but I think it's a winnable game. Yeah.
So thinking about the injuries that happened yesterday and just, again, the win that got taken out of fans, the team, watching Micah Parsons go down like that, what were you expecting Matt LaFleur to do to salvage the game, knowing what, like, the cards that he had left in his hand?
I didn't think a win or a loss really mattered. You're not playing a divisional opponent. You're not playing. I mean, you were still winning by whatever it was, 9 points when all of this went down, but you lose Christian Watson. You lose Zach Tom, your right tackle. You lose Evan Williams, your star safety. You lose Micah Parsons. You're losing so many critical pieces to how you're going to win. I mean, you could argue those are four.
Was yesterday a coaching failure?
No, I don't think so. No,
think yesterday was a coaching failure?
No, I'm not talking about yesterday. I'm talking about going forward.
Okay.
And my criticism of Matt LaFleur is that he has, I think, critically, last year, Chicago last game, this year, Cleveland and Carolina.
Yeah, there's been some shortcomings.
He created an offense. This is what Wilde's point always is. How dare we as fans question Matt LaFleur's genius as play caller?
No, I think it's clear he's had his shortcomings. I'm not arguing that.
Absolutely.
But I think he has certainly turned it around as of late. I thought the four-game winning streak they brought into Denver yesterday, especially the three divisional games that they played in a row, I thought were some of his best called games of the season. Now, yesterday, I thought all in all was a pretty good well-called game, right? The first interception to Surtain, the reigning defensive player of the year, where Watson got hurt, that was just an underthrown ball by Jordan Love. The second interception, that goes off the hands of Dontavian Wicks and into the defender's hands. So neither of those I would blame on LaFleur. One of those I would blame on Love. And that's just football for you, I think. So I don't know that LaFleur had a bad day yesterday.
No, I'm not saying he had a bad day yesterday. I just say I pointed out some games where
outstanding.
I want him to understand the limitations of this team as it exists this Saturday night and create a game plan or scenarios that put you in the best possible position in a very tough environment.
I'll tell you what, my eye's more on the defensive coordinator, Jeff Kaplan.
Yeah, he did not look good yesterday.
No, he didn't. Mm-hmm. And obviously, when you lose Micah Parsons and Evan Williams, as I mentioned, with the knee injury, that's going to hurt your defense when those have been two of your brightest stars. But when it comes to specifically Chicago, we saw they played in the second half defensively last week. Chicago could do whatever they wanted, and then their quarterback, who's a young quarterback, made a dumb play that ultimately sealed the game for Green Bay. So I want to see how this defense responds without Micah Parsons, because this is a guy who's being rumored as one of the hottest, and not, don't get me twisted, Kristen, like the last time I joined you guys, we're not talking hot head coaches today, but one of the hottest head coaching candidates next year is Jeff Hafley, so this is a prove-it game for him as well.
This is a resume item.
Totally.
As it were, right?
This is a divisional game. You win Sunday, or Saturday, rather, I guess it is. I think you win the division.
So historically, knowing the position that Micah Parsons plays, because we've seen people come back from an ACL tear, right? Yeah. Whether we're talking about basketball, football, is it different because of his position that people are scared as far as even if he recovers, he'll never be the same?
Well, I think people are scared, specifically Packers fans, because the guy opposite of him, Rashawn Gary, had an ACL tear, and since he's come back, he just hasn't been effective. And that's a guy who's maybe been the biggest disappointment this season for the Packers defense is Rashawn Gary. So they've seen it with a guy who is a physical freak, and it just hasn't been better. But you could make the opposite argument. Christian Watson tore his ACL this calendar year. He tore his ACL back
that's
in January. And he's been awesome since he came back.
Yeah.
So the good news for Micah is that guy is an absolute freak of a human being. And you put a challenge in front of him, I think he's going to kill it.
All right, he is Alex Stroh. 94.5 ESPN is where he does most of his work, but he's also joining us every once in a while, especially during Packers season. And, of course, fantastic game day program, which I will be joining you for the Ravens game.
Yes.
In a couple weeks. Not on vacation.
Good for you.
How about that? And you can join him at this fantastic event Wednesday night. I have a dinner engagement, otherwise I would be there.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah. It is the Hot House Tavern in Menominee Falls, 7 p.m. Join us. Capco's Kids and Kids Toy Drive. I know you're a tremendous human being. I know you love doing this stuff.
Appreciate it. Yeah. It's an awesome cause, and it's the last one we're doing for WTMJ Trivia, so make sure you come out. Hot House Tavern on Wednesday at 7 o'clock.
All right. Tell Wildy to lighten up. All right. Quick break here on 620 WTMJ.
Well, as a little bit of a palate cleanser for Wisconsin sports, obviously the game ended. It was very sad. And then it just rolled into the Badger Women's Volleyball Elite Eight game against UT Austin. And we kept the game on. I think it was already set one had already started. And I did not play volleyball, despite being taller than the average bear for women. But at 5'10", I would be a shorty in D1 volleyball, because those women are very tall and can jump very high. And what I did not realize, I think I'm getting this right, in the last 10 championship games for D1 volleyball, either Nebraska or UT Austin has been in the game. Both lost yesterday.
Wild.
And so the Wisconsin Women Badger volleyball team has advanced to the Final Four, and they dominated. They did lose one set, but they really dominated the entire game. It was so much fun to watch, especially with a daughter who will likely be tall. And, it, you know, what's also very cool, as I saw yesterday, Team USA Women's Hockey, there's like 9 Badgers on that team.
Oh, yeah, great program.
And so it is, as far as at least a celebration with the Packers loss, still watching the women's volleyball team dominate, move on, hopefully get to the championship game, hopefully win it all, because I think we obviously have a chance to.
And correct me if I'm wrong, didn't they win it all like 2 or 3 years ago, women's volleyball? I think so.
I know we're always good. I don't know if we won the whole
thing. Jazz will look that
if we won the whole thing. We always do well, but I feel like we always come a little bit short. For hockey, we always, we make it to the championship game, it's like us or Ohio.
But how about the women at UW representing? How about that?
Well, it was also very funny because, so the game ended, we were cheering, we were excited. And then Carter Booth, who is a senior, they were interviewing her, and both Mike and I looked at each other like, did she just say that? Because they did not bleep it on the live broadcast. But here is a little taste of what her enthusiasm led her to say.
Carter, you've been able to reach a different level. What's allowed that in your last tournament run?
I mean, like I told you when we spoke earlier in practice, I refuse to lose. Sorry, guys, but I refuse.
Yeah.
I refuse, and this team refuses. And I think that's the mindset that we've had going through this tournament.
Sorry, guys.
Refuse to lose.
Put that on a t-shirt. And so I'm very excited to continue to watch them as we move forward in this tournament.
And Jazz looked it up. They won in 2021.
Okay.
So they have a precedent. Good luck to the UW Wisconsin women's volleyball players. It's like laid out for them. That is some good news on what is not a Victory Monday.
It's a different kind of Victory Monday.
Yes. All right. She's Chris and I'm Steve. We'll wrap it up after this. All right, all through the holidays, I'm trying to give you my best pay it forward tips. Now, this one is something I did for
tips and stories.
So this is a story from my trip. We went to a great Packer bar in Long Beach, California, called The Stash or Stashes. Fantastic. Mobbed by Packers fans. And it's actually on the Packers website, which I didn't know until after. Fun place. So the special there was $3 Miller High Lifes.
Unheard of in California.
Wow. You can't even find those in Wisconsin sometimes.
Wow.
Well, some places. So I consumed, I'll be honest, I had about 6 during the course of the 5 hours I was there, which is not a ton, but my wife goes, you're a little loopy after this game. Well,
this was the Bears game.
I saw him
beat obviously you were already home yesterday.
Yes. Yeah, I saw him beat the Bears. So and we had an appetizer, we had lunch, and then Kathy was drinking her Diet Cokes like she always does. The whole bill comes as $44.
I'm
like, I gave her a $50 tip. One, and she was so appreciative. This is like a young woman who's just like, you know, doing hustling. There was probably 150 people in this place. She was the sole waitress. Can you imagine what? How many
probably
of
made
us,
a lot of money that day?
She
but
did.
I was also a little stressed out.
But I thought, you know what? If I would have done that anywhere else, let's say Vegas, or you know, I would have expected the bill to be $100. So I just took that expectation and I more than doubled her the tip. I just think that's little things you can do. It doesn't have to be $50, it could be $10. But when you talk about
over tip,
everybody's doing what they're working while you're celebrating, right? They're hustling. She was bringing food out and slinging drinks and like doing everything. And I think her name was Anna. Nice job, Anna. I mean, incredible. To handle that many people? Are you serious? So well done her. So little things like that can make someone's day. And she was so appreciative. And I didn't do it for that reason. I wanted to do the right thing. And that was the right thing in that case. So do whatever you can. I'll continue to give you some ideas as we go forward.
Mine is leave any small business right now that you appreciate. Your hairdresser, your nail salon, your restaurant that you love. Go leave them a good review on Google or Facebook or anywhere that they generate marketing for themselves. That tell the people, tell them on your own social media, even if you don't have a big following. Share a small business that you really love in this holiday season to try to maybe generate some more business for them.
All right, we'll be back tomorrow.
We'll do it again.
Good to be back. News is next.